Welcome to another Salvation by Grace message from Grace Christian Assembly in Smyrna, Tennessee. We are currently engaged in a verse-by-verse Bible study of the Gospel of Matthew. Now, let's join the congregation of GCA and our teaching pastor, Jim McLarty.
Been in a lot of churches and heard a lot of musicians, but I like the GCA musicians a lot. Not only because they're talented guys, but because their hearts are in the right place. Yeah, they're church musicians. I had a conversation once with a pastor. He was discussing which musical instruments were appropriate for church. I think you need to draw a few lines, like if you walk into a church and there's like bagpipes and an accordion,
amen.
Then I like bagpipes, but not with an accordion. You know, especially if you throw a banjo in there, you know, then it's just all, but anyway. How about drums? I know. See, that's a big issue in some churches. What about drums? My opinion is that any musical instrument that is played by a person with the right heart and right attitude is fair game. Even the drums. A drum, by the way, is an inanimate object. It can't sin and it can't do righteousness. So its relative value in the worship of God is dependent on the heart of the person utilizing the drum. Right?
Right.
Right. So that is not preparing you for the idea that I'm bringing drums in here or anything. So that's not, no. Despite the fact that Jill has been after me for a couple of months now going, when are you going to bring some drums? Yeah. As promised, we are beginning the book of Matthew this morning. I don't know how far into the actual book we'll get because this morning's going to be an introduction to the book of Matthew. And then you're going to have to kind of hold on to all the information that you'll get this morning because the next two Sundays I'll be gone. Next Sunday, our friend, my friend, your friend, our good friend, Barney Johnson, will be standing here preaching to us. I know, did you hear that? There was an audible, oh, in the room from people who were glad to get to see Barney. He stopped by at homecoming, but didn't get to preach, and so he'll be standing here next Sunday. The Sunday after that, Alex will be standing here, and that's when the cookout and picnic will be happening, because you guys will be celebrating while the cat's away. The mice will be, yeah, and having a good time. No, Jim, party! And then, so make sure that you sign up back there for what you would like to bring and side dishes you'd like to bring. And then I'm going to ask you all to do me a favor. In my entire life growing up in the church, I have always known that it's tougher to get people to come to a midweek service than it is a Sunday morning service. And so I'm just accustomed to the fact that our midweek services are, shall we say, less attended than our Sunday morning services. But we have the recordings going and the camera and it goes out on the internet, so I'm accustomed to the fact that there's a larger audience for what we're doing than just the folks in the room. I'll be here this Wednesday. But the following Wednesday, Robert Stone's going to be standing up here doing the teaching. And the favor I'm asking of all of you is make plans to be here that Wednesday night. Even if you can't drag yourself up to GCA to go hear Jim do a whole year of systematic theology, which he's been doing consistently and faithfully now for 52 lessons, if that's not enough to get you out of your house, then come hear Robert at very least, okay? So that there's a good group of encouragers here for him. So that's what's coming up. On Wednesday night, I brought a stool in, which is right here, and Wednesday night I sat on that stool and taught. And before this morning is over, I may give in and go for the stool. But I'm thankful for lidocaine pads, that's all I can tell you. Better living through modern chemistry. In order to understand the book of Matthew, you have to understand a little bit of the history of what was happening, what was going on in national Israel when Jesus appeared on the stage of history. You have to kind of understand what had been going on, what the expectation was. Because Matthew, chronologically, the first book of the New Testament, is also the most Jewish of the four Gospels. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the name Arnold Fruchtenbaum, and I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, but he is a Jewish writer who wrote a book called Israelology, The Missing Link in Systematic Theology. I read the book, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. I liked it a lot. I'm not necessarily saying run out and get it, because it is his doctoral thesis, and it's very dry, but very good. Lots of good information in it. The reason that I bring him up is that I also received a copy of his testimony, that being raised Jewish, his conversion to Christianity was a surprise to him and all of his family, because he had actually been taught that Christians hated Jews and that Christians and Jews were at polar opposites with each other. And so even though he was very studied in the Tanakh, the Old Testament, even though he was very studied in Torah, even though he knew the Hebrew scriptures very, very well, he had never ventured into the New Testament, because he had always believed that that was where you would find all that bad, made-up, wrong, evil stuff. He said he was in college and had a conversation with somebody who challenged him to read the New Testament on the basis of, you criticize it. Why do you criticize something you haven't read? This is kind of a good standard for pretty much everybody. You don't criticize things you don't know about. And so based on that challenge, he opened the New Testament. And according to his own testimony, he said he was shocked as he began reading the New Testament, which meant he began reading Matthew. And he said, and it was Jewish. It was all very Jewish. He said it was very familiar. It was talking about things I understood, and it was making reference repeatedly back to the law and the prophets. Matthew quotes from the Old Testament more than the others, because he is trying to draw a direct chronological connection between the Old Covenant into the New. And Matthew, more than the other three really, is emphasizing to his Jewish audience that Jesus is the promised Messiah. And so if you don't know the Old Testament language of the kingdom, if you don't know the Old Testament language of Messiah, if you don't know the Old Testament prophecies and promises concerning national Israel, then Matthew's really not going to mean much to you, because Matthew is writing to an audience that already knows all that. And that's one of the reasons that I waited for quite a while to get to the book of Matthew. We've taught through John, and we've taught through Luke and Acts, and we taught through those books verse by verse on purpose, because they were written to audiences very much like us. They were written to Gentile audiences, and therefore we were able to approach them at face value. But it's taken years for us to reach a point where we're familiar enough with Israelology as a topic, Old Testament Israel as a concept, the promises made to national Israel. I think we as a church are finally to a point where we're familiar enough with all that, that now we can approach Matthew and not damage it. I have heard a lot of damage done to the Gospel of Matthew in my lifetime, because people have tried to pigeonhole it, force it into a 21st century Gentile mindset and framework. And it doesn't fit there. And so the only way to understand the book of Matthew is to understand it in its very, very Jewish context. And we will be doing a lot of that as we work through the book, which means that we're also going to continue getting a more expanded understanding of the Old Testament and the promises and national Israel and their history. And that's all a very good thing, because the Bible is primarily about God's relationship with his chosen people, Israel. And we Gentiles are brought into this covenant of salvation by grace through faith as a result of God's goodness and grace to us. But it wasn't ours by covenant. It wasn't ours by promise. It wasn't ours for any other reason than the goodness and grace of God. And it's damaging to the text of Matthew when we who have been brought in by grace think, oh, now this book is all about me. And it's not. It's all about God's continuing faithfulness to Israel in sending Israel a Messiah. Now, as I mentioned, each of the four Gospels were written to different audiences for different purposes. For instance, when we studied the book of Luke, we talked about the fact that Luke, writing to a Gentile, he's writing to Theophilus, who is a Greek. Both the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts are both written by Luke the physician to this Theophilus, this Greek guy. And so the function, the purpose for why Luke is writing, and the reason that he chooses the particular stories that he chooses, the reason that he recites the particular quotes that he cites, is that he is trying to prove that Jesus is the perfect quintessential man, which is the Greek ideal. That's why the Greeks began things like the Olympics, and why they had massive libraries. That's why we have so much Greek philosophy, is because they were attempting to find, to create the ideal man who is intellectually and physically and spiritually perfect. And Luke is writing and saying, we have found that man. He's Jesus. Now Mark writes from the perspective, even though he's writing to a largely Gentile audience, and even though historically it's probably really Peter's gospel, and Mark is kind of writing what Peter has passed on to him, but Mark is writing to prove that Jesus is the suffering servant, because this was a really difficult thing, especially for the first century Jews, to comprehend that their Messiah came and died. That wasn't the way it was supposed to work. He was supposed to come and set up the kingdom and rule from Jerusalem, and the nations all flow to him. And that's not what he did. He came, he died, he rose, he sailed up off the planet, and he's gone now. And so Mark is really writing that he is fulfilling that Isaiah 53 suffering servant thing. Mark is the shortest of the three Gospels. And the vast majority of what you find in Mark is also in Matthew. And so as we cover the book of Matthew, we'll also be cross-referencing some of the stuff that's in the Markian Gospel. Matthew, as I said, is writing to prove that Jesus is the Messiah to come. He's the one that is the culmination, the fulfillment of all those Old Testament promises of a king coming to Israel. He also is going to represent Jesus as the new lawgiver that Moses promised. And that he is, unlike all of the Pharisees and like the lawyers and the ones who interpreted the law, that Jesus is not just an interpreter of the law, he is the new lawgiver. So he is the ideal explainer of God in the law. And so he's really going to bear down on that. John says that Jesus is, that he is God incarnate. That's the point of John's gospel. So you've got Matthew first, he is the Messiah. You've got Mark next, the Messiah is also the suffering servant. You've got Luke next, he is not just God, but he is a man and he is the ideal man. And then you've got John saying, and he is the Son of God, which is why he starts with, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And nothing was made that wasn't made by him and through him and for him. And so there is a method to the four Gospels. And if you understand that, then you can understand why they pick the particular stories they pick, why they quote the particular quotes that they quote, because they have a purpose for writing. At the end of the book of John, John says, I wrote these particular things so that you would believe. But if we were to write everything that Jesus said and did, he said, I don't suppose that the world could contain all the books that would be written about him. Well, now 2,000 years later, there sure are a lot of books written about him, aren't there? But those four particular eyewitness accounts exist for the purpose of saying that he is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. He is the Messiah to come. He is the King of Israel. He is the ideal man. He is the suffering servant. And he is God incarnate walking on the planet in human flesh. And if you put those four Gospels together, you get a very complete Christology. This is who Christ is. Now, as I said a moment ago, in order to understand how earth-shattering the beginning of Matthew is, you have to understand what happened at the end of the Old Testament. You've heard me say many times, the Old Testament, you can look it up yourself. In fact, if you went to Matthew 1:1 and went back a page, you would be at the very end of the last book of the Old Testament, Malachi, which is historically also the last book written and the last book before God becomes silent. And for 400 years, God stops talking to Israel. And the last word of the last communication from God, the last word in the Old Testament is the word curse. The Old Testament ends with the word curse. Israel has been in rebellion. Israel has been through multiple deportations out of their land. Israel is in a desperate state. And on top of that, God has stopped talking to them. The prophets have all gone silent. And for 400 years, now think about how long that is. We've been a nation a little more than 200 years. 1976 to now, what's that, about 30 years? 230-something years we've been a nation. Okay, now double that. And for that long, national Israel, who were used to hearing from God on a regular basis, haven't heard from God. Which means that whole generations of people came and went and heard stories about, you know, God used to talk to us. You know, God used to guide us. You know, God used to show up in the tabernacle and he would fill the place with smoke and he would let us know that he was present. And he talked to us through the prophets and he made us promises and he gave us deliverances and he'd given us judges and he gave us kings and he took care of us. And now Israel has spent all this time under Grecian dominion and then under Roman dominion and God's been quiet. And Israel doesn't know what to do about it. In fact, during that period of time, this is called the intertestamental period of time. This is basically from the end of Malachi to the beginning of Matthew. That 400-year period, Israel continues doing what Israel has always done, which is record their history. They're still writing down things that happen. A few minutes ago, I used the word Tanakh. Are you familiar with Tanakh? It's basically the three Hebrew letters that translated into English would be T-N-K, the law, the writing, and the prophets. And so Jesus often referred to the whole Old Testament as the law and the prophets. And so the word, to sum that up, became this word, Tanakh. Now, the Tanakh is made up of the first five books of Moses, which are the law, the Torah. And then you have the writing. And then you have the prophets. Now, when God stopped talking, the prophets got quiet. But they continued the writing. Writings are things like the history books, your Kings and your Chronicles. Or even later, the time of Ezra and Nehemiah and the rebuilding of the temple. It's a lot of narrative. It's a lot of story. The story of Israel's history. They had always been very good about keeping their history written down. Well, that's exactly what continued during the intertestamental period. Israel continued to write what was going on. They had historians that wrote. But because it didn't come from the mouth of prophets, they didn't consider it inspired word of God. So oftentimes they bound it with their inspired scripture, but it was considered what was called the hidden books. And so these hidden books, the word is apocrypha. So the apocryphal or hidden books were oftentimes bound with the Old Testament books, but Israel knew these are not inspired books. They didn't come from God through the prophets. Now, in the midst of that intertestamental history, we read about the fact that there were no prophets in Israel. For instance, are you familiar with 1st and 2nd Maccabees? Have you ever heard of those books? Well, these are intertestamental history books that are about basically Judas Maccabeus, whose name means the hammer. That's a good name. And he's the one who led Israel in standing against the encroachments of a Greek general whose name was Antiochus. Antiochus, who gave himself the name, he's Antiochus the Fourth, I believe. He gave himself the name Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus is God. He's the one who, during this period, when God is quiet, he's the one who invades the temple and then sacrifices a pig on the altar. And so as the armies of Antiochus are sweeping in, who, by the way, Daniel predicted. Daniel said that this was going to happen, these kings of the north, kings of the south. The end of that series of kings of the north is this Antiochus who was going to come in and defame the temple the way that he did, defile the temple. And so what are we going to do with the temple furniture now? What are we going to do? The temple's been defiled. What are we going to do about all of this? Well, we read in 1 Maccabees 9:27, which is right around 160 B.C. I'm sorry, I'm going to go back. 1 Maccabees 4:45 and 46, right around 164 B.C. A good counsel came into their minds, thinking about what to do with this defiled furniture and the altar. And a good counsel came into their mind to pull it down, lest it should be a reproach to them, because the Gentiles had defiled it. So they threw it down, and they laid up the stones of it, not knowing what to do with it. It's still the altar of God. What do we do with it? So they laid up the stones of it in a mountain of the temple in a convenient place until there should come a prophet and give an answer concerning them. There's no prophet. So there's a history. You know, what do we do? Okay, the temple's been defiled. Okay, Antiochus has come in and done the Gentiles have defiled our temple. What do we do? Well, let's just take it down and hide it until a prophet shows up. That's how important a prophet was to them. But God wasn't talking. A minute ago I mentioned 1 Maccabees 9:27. So there was a great distress in Israel, the worst since the time when the prophets ceased to appear among them. It was a mark in time for national Israel, this mark in time when the prophets stopped talking. And for 400 years, nothing. But there's still war. There's still encroachments. There's still the defiling of their temple. And they don't know what to do because their history had always been, go ask God. And they go ask God, and God's not answering. 1 Maccabees 14:1 says, therefore the Jews and the priests are happy to have Simon and his descendants as their leaders and their high priests until a true prophet appears. So they continued to have their high priests, they continued to have their services, but they were just going through the rote routine of the religion until a true prophet would come tell them what to do. Are you familiar with Josephus? Do you know who Josephus is? He is a Jewish historian who wrote, he lived between 39 and 100 AD, so right in that post-Jesus period. He wrote a book called Against Appian. Chapter 1, verses 38 to 42, talks about this situation within Israel, and it says, and it's comparing, by the way, Josephus is comparing the fact that the Jews have their inspired books. And he, being a Jew, is comparing their inspired books to all the religious books that Rome has and that the Greeks have. The Greeks, of course, have their whole pantheon of gods that the Romans adopted and gave new names. Same guys, new names. And so you have Greco-Roman mythology, and you have people making all kinds of things up. And so Josephus writes, we do not have an innumerable multitude of books among us disagreeing from and contradicting one another as the Greeks have, but only 22 books which contain the record of all past times, which are justly believed to be divine. And of them, 5 belong to Moses, which contain his laws and the traditions of the origin of mankind till his death. And this interval of time was little short of 3,000 years. But as to the time from the death of Moses till the reign of Artaxerxes, the king of Persia, who reigned after Xerxes, the prophets who were after Moses wrote down what was done in their times in 13 books. Do you understand what's being said here? He said, from the time of Moses until the time of Xerxes. The reason that's important is that's the time of the Persian kings, the Greco-Roman incursions. This is the time when the prophets got silent. And so between Moses and the time of Artaxerxes, He said, during that time, the prophet spoke, and we have it written down. But there has not been an exact succession of prophets since that time. And how firmly we have given credit to these books of our own nation is evident by what we do. For during so many ages as have already passed, no one has been so bold as either to add anything to them or take anything from them or to make any change in them. But it has become natural or an instinct to all Jews immediately and from their very birth to esteem these books to contain divine doctrines and to persist in them and, if occasion be, to willingly die for them. And so Josephus says, the canon is closed. The Old Testament is closed, and we know it's true because it comes from the prophets. But he also said, but we have no prophet now. We've been waiting for a prophet. 400 years, nothing. By the way, then, if you understand that God is like that, then it shouldn't surprise you if you go to God in prayer and he doesn't answer immediately. He has a history of waiting for his proper time. I like the phrase that God is always on time, but not quite always according to our time. We would like God to always answer us right now, immediately, instantaneously. Hey, God, I'm asking. I would like an answer now. What if he waited 400 years? Because he did. Israel's waiting. They're waiting for deliverance. They're waiting for Messiah. They're waiting for the kingdom. They've got all these promises. They have all these prophecies. They have all this evidence. They have all this proof. They have all these covenants. They have the kingdom of David. They have the household of Solomon. They know what it is to once rule the world. They know what it is to have the nations flow to them. And they have all these consistent prophecies that God is going to again raise them up, establish them, plant them in their land, make them safe again, and that a son of David is going to come and rule over them. Despite those promises and despite their expectation, nothing. 400 years. So can you see why Jesus walking on the planet and announcing himself at his baptism and the Spirit of God coming down in the form of a dove, lighting on him, and a voice from heaven says, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. God is talking. For the first time in 400 years, Israel's hearing from God. And he's making his Son the final prophet. He's the one. Which is why it is so important at the Mount of Transfiguration that Peter, John, and James could be there to witness it when Jesus is flanked by Moses and Elijah. Elijah, the ultimate prophet. Moses, the embodiment of the law. The law and the prophets on either side of Jesus. And when Peter tries to equate the three of them, God speaks again and says, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. Hear him. Peter looks up, Moses and Elijah are gone. And Jesus in his glory is standing there. Because he's it. He's God speaking. He's the prophet of God. He's the Son of God. He's the descendant of David. He is the Messiah. He is the king who's going to establish the kingdom. And then, on top of that, he walks around doing signs, wonders, and miracles that no man has ever done. Things that make the prophets look like pikers by comparison. And then says things like, your entire eternity is wrapped up in what you think of me. And he places himself at the center of the religious universe and says, it's all about me. It's God talking. And he's not just talking, and he's walking, and he's eating, and he's telling, and he's explaining, and he's comforting, and he's drawing, and he's teaching. So So I don't want you to think that the beginning of Matthew is just an extension of the Old Testament, as if God just said, here's some stuff, and here's some stuff, and here's some stuff, and here's Jesus. What he said was, here's some stuff, and here's some promises, and here's some covenants. And then because they continued to rebel, he left them in that state where he was just silent, and their temple was defiled and destroyed. The next temple that was still standing when Jesus was on the planet was Herod's temple, which, by the way, never had the Ark of the Covenant in it, because the Ark of the Covenant had been missing ever since the time of Jeremiah. And so there was never a true communication through that temple between the high priest and God. In fact, I think it's one of the reasons why when Jesus died, that great big thick curtain that separated the holiest place from the rest of the temple, it was torn open from the top to the bottom. And even though people have speculated about why, I think one of the reasons was to show it's empty. There's nothing going on in here. If you want to get to God, that's not the way. You have to go through Jesus. He's the way, he's the truth, he's the life. So God had been silent, and then God talked to Israel through Jesus. And that was cataclysmic. They'd been waiting. Can you see why we're going to read things like, and the common people heard him gladly? Yeah. Can you see why the Pharisees would hate him? Because for 400 years, they've been doing it their way. For 400 years, hey, God's quiet. We can make up our own stuff. We can just impose and interpret the law any way we want. We'll make ourselves rich. We'll make you do things our way. And then Jesus shows up and they ask him, what authority do you have to talk like this? Because they're the authority. As far as they're concerned, they've got the Old Testament, they've got the religious authority, and he walks around condemning them and saying things like, you're whitewashed sepulchers. You look good on the outside, and on the inside, you're all dead men's bones and uncleanness. Just out there making friends. He called them a generation of vipers, a den of thieves. And he's God talking. So, Matthew, turn to Matthew 9:9. Let's start with, how did Matthew become an apostle? Because there was not a sign-up sheet. There was not a recruiting drive. There was not a, come be an apostle. See the world. And die. Yeah. Matthew 9:9 says, and as Jesus passed on from there, he saw a man called Matthew, Matthias would have been his Greek name, saw him sitting in the tax office, and he said to him, follow me. And he rose and he followed him. Okay, this is astounding. First off, I like that Matthew just mentions one sentence about his own conversion. I mean, if you were Matthew, wouldn't you expand on that for a while? You know, and I saw in him that he was a really good man, and I saw that he was probably, and it was probably beneficial for me. No, Matthew admits the same way that John does when he recounts it. Jesus walked up to them while they're on their job and said, come with me. And they get up, leave their jobs, leave their tax rolls, leave their fishing nets, and they follow him. This is what we call an effectual call. This is Jesus as the sovereign saying to somebody, you're mine. And they go, okay, yeah, apparently I'm yours. Now, he's a publican. He's a tax collector, which means that he's highly hated by the Jews because his job is to tax his fellow countrymen with heavy, onerous taxes and then take that money and give it to Rome, who are the Gentile overlords of the Middle East at that time. And not only that, Rome is pretty good about making the publicans pretty rich. As you're going to see, when Matthew is converted, he has Jesus over to his private house and throws a party and invites his other tax collector friends. He's not a poor fellow, but he's a hated fellow. Now, Jesus, who, like I said, is just out there making friends and influencing people, could have called the really likable folks. He could have called the people who, the Israelites all agreed, that's a really good guy, go get him. He doesn't. He goes and gets fishermen and tax collectors. To give you some idea what Israelites thought of tax collectors, Jesus gives instruction about what to do if somebody in the congregation was in sin. He says, you go to him privately and you speak to him, and perhaps you'll win your brother. If he won't hear you, you go back two or three witnesses, so that at the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word is confirmed. If he won't hear you and the witnesses, you take him in front of the congregation, and if he won't hear the congregation, you cast him out and treat him like a publican or a sinner. Wait, what? Out of all the different jobs there are in Israel, you went with publican for how we're supposed to treat him? That's how hated the publicans were. And Jesus walks up to a hated publican and says, follow me. 2,000 years later, we're still reading the account of this publican who was despised by his fellow countrymen and loved by Christ. Again, isn't it good to know that Christ can love the unlovable? Amen. Isn't that good to know? Turn over to the book of Luke real quick. Go to Luke 5. Luke tells us more about the conversion of Matthew. Matthew just gives us that one sentence. Go to Luke 5. I'm going to start in verse 27. And after that, he, Jesus, went out and he noticed a publican, a tax gatherer named Levi. That's his Jewish name. Matthias, like I said, is his Greek name. By the way, with the name Levi, he's probably from the tribe of Levi. By the way, in order to be a tax collector, he had to be educated. He had to be good with numbers. He had to be mathematically adept. He had to be good with language. He had to be able to keep track of things. He had to be able to keep a log. He is a perfect candidate to write a gospel. Interesting that the other one, Luke, happened to be a doctor, a physician, well-educated. Jesus is in favor of smart people. I like that, because far too often Christianity is represented as if it's just kind of dumb or for dumb people, and that if you believe those old fairy tales and old wives' tales, you must not be very smart either. In many, many churches, the first requirement for attendance is that you chop the top of your head off. But I like the fact, I like the fact that Christianity is intelligent. After all, he's the Son of God. He's the one who spoke everything into existence. I figure he's probably pretty smart. And he knows how to collect smart people. Paul, by the way, studied at the feet of Gamaliel, very intelligent, very studied, highly educated man, highly influential man. I like the fact that Jesus brought those kind of people in along with the fishermen and along with the sinners and the prostitutes and the other folk that he brought into his circle. So after that, he went out and he noticed a tax gatherer named Levi sitting in the tax office, and he said, follow me. Notice the next phrase. And he, Matthew, left everything behind and rose and began to follow Jesus. On the simple command, follow me, Matthew put down his job, walked away from his livelihood, walked away from his Roman bosses, which, by the way, is a little dangerous. In verse 29 says, and he gave a big reception for him at his house. What does that tell you about the size of his house?
Big house.
He's got a big house where he throws a big party. He's so enamored with this man who he believes to be the Messiah. And I don't even know. I can't wait to get to heaven and find these people. I have questions. I just want to say, you're sitting there, you're working, you're keeping track, and a man shows up and says, follow me. Did you know right away? Did you know he was Messiah? How did you know? How did you put down everything and realize that your life was wrapped up in him from that moment forward? All I can assume is that when the sovereign speaks, it is. And if he says, let there be light, there's light. And if he says to you, follow me, you'll follow him. It's the only explanation I have, by the way, for why any of you are following him. It can only be because he sovereignly said to you, "You're mine." And ever since then, you've gone, "Yep." Anybody here ever tried to get away? You were much too quick to respond, Rhonda. Rhonda actually went, "Oh, yeah." Yeah, not just "yeah," but "oh, yeah." Oh, yeah. Yeah, we tried to get away. So why aren't you away? On a Sunday morning, here you sit. Why? Because he said, "Follow me," and you have no choice. And I assume that's what happened with Matthew. But not only that, he was so excited about leaving that job and following Messiah that he threw a big banquet, a big party to invite people to say, "Look who I found. Look who it is." Now, again, you can kind of comprehend this if you're living in that period of time where for 400 years, God hasn't talked. God hasn't spoken. No prophecy, nothing. And then here is Messiah walking on the planet. Can you see why Matthew would say, "Throw a party"? God's talking. Messiah's here. So he threw a big reception in his house, and there was a great crowd of tax gatherers and other people who were reclining at the table with them. You know, they didn't have chairs or stools. They would recline, sit on the ground, lean against each other around a, you know, small table or a short table. I like the fact that he gathered his other tax collectors. He went out and called sinners. Come see the Messiah. Verse 30. And the Pharisees and the scribes began grumbling at his disciples, saying, "Why do you eat and drink with the tax gatherers and the sinners?" Do you think Jesus knew that was the reaction he was going to get when he chose Matthew? Sure he did. He's upsetting the established religious order. He's doing it on purpose. He's not sitting with the religious and the elite. I expect that the leaders in the temple would have been very satisfied if he had shown up in the temple, done some miracles, proved he was Messiah, and then said, "And I'm one of you guys." Well, then the Pharisees and the lawyers would have all said, "Well, yes, we like you, because you're with us." He wasn't with them at all. He was completely contrary to them, and he went out and ate and drank at banquets with the hated people. I mean, how much does the law say about a prostitute? What are you supposed to do with a prostitute? Kill her! Stone her! That's his crowd. Or tax gatherers, highly hit, that's his crowd. Fishermen, lowly, don't, that's his crowd. So the Pharisees and the scribes began grumbling at his disciples and saying, "Why do you eat and drink with the tax gatherers and the sinners?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "It's not those who are well who need a physician, but those who are sick." Okay, that's an axiomatic truth. It costs me, because of my current insurance policy, it costs me a lot of money to go see my doctor. Because the first $3,000 of every year is on me. These lidocaine pads I told you I'm wearing right now, $230. That was my half of 30 of these pads, okay? Okay, so because it's so expensive, I have never made a doctor appointment to go see my doctor and say, "Just wanted to say hi. Just came by to see how you're doing. How's it going? What's that going to cost me? Let me write a check." No, you don't seek a physician till you're sick. And even then, when you're sick and know you're sick. Sometimes you're sick and you go, "I can last it out. I don't need a doctor yet. I don't need a doctor yet. I'm not paying that money yet. I don't need a doctor." When you're sick and you know you're sick, you go find a doctor. Okay, well, Jesus is using that in order to say, "I haven't come to call the righteous." So the Pharisees and the people who think they're doing fine and they've got the law down and they think they're establishing their own personal righteousness on the basis of their law keeping, Jesus says, "I didn't come for you." Well, there goes Jesus again, dividing people up. He was never a universalist. He never said, I'm here for absolutely anybody who chooses me or decides or makes a profession or makes me Lord and Savior. It was always up to him. He was effectually calling people. He was building his church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. He was the one who was always in control and in command of who came to him, how and when they came to him. And to some people, he looked him in the eye and said, not you. Because you think you're right. You think you're righteous. You think you're good. I came for people who are sick and know it. I came for sinners. People who know they're sinners. People who know they're desperate. And by the way, that's still the way that God draws people. Because part of what he will do for you is show you your desperate estate, show you you're a sinner, show you how badly you need a Savior, and introduce you to Christ. Because people who are doing well and doing fine and it's all good and they feel whole and healthy and they feel like they're in control, those are not the people who are looking for a Redeemer. Because they're fine. And this again is part of the tragedy of so much of religion and so much of so-called Christianity that encourages people to do good, do better, so that they will be accepted by God. They say, you can be good, you can be right, you can be religiously appropriate so that God then will accept you on that basis. And they ignore the fact that Jesus says, that's not who I came for. If you're deluded enough to think that you can be good enough, that you can obligate God to save you, I got nothing for you, and neither does Christ. But if you can see that you are desperate, that you are a sinner, that you are depraved, that you are fallen, and that God is right, and that God is holy, and God is just, and that the only way you're going to get to him is if he does something for you, oh, well, then we've got the gospel for you. Then we've got the remarkably good news that Jesus saves sinners. And he's the one who said it. He's the one that created that dividing line and said to religious people who thought they were good and right and just, I got nothing for you. I came for sinners. Luke 6, turn over there real quick, starting at verse 12. Starting in verse 12, it was at this time that he went off to the mountain to pray. And he spent the whole night in prayer to God. And when he came, he called his disciples to him, which means all the people who were following under the discipline, listening. And out of the disciples, he chose 12 of them, whom he named as apostles. Apostolos, it means sent ones. No longer just learners, no longer just under the discipline, but now these are the ones he's going to train, he's going to teach, and he's going to send. And these are the 12, Simon, whom he also named Peter, Andrew, his brother, and James and John, those are the sons of Zebedee, the sons of thunder, and Philip and Bartholomew, and Matthew and Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot. Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. So Jesus chose every one of them, made them apostles, and even chose the one who was going to betray him. That's how much control he was in, so that he could walk up to people and say, "You're mine." That was all introduction. Go to Matthew 1:1. The book of Matthew starts right out with a genealogy. As we've been studying systematic theology in the midweek, we've talked about words that end in L-O-G-Y. What is the Greek word that is the basis of the L-O-G-Y?
Logos.
Logos, logia, exactly. So it's words or words about. Words about something. Words about theos is theology. words about Christos, Christology, words about the spirit, pneuma, pneumatology. And so here we have this word, genealogy. This is the English word, but the English word is a combination of two Greek words, the logia, and the Greek word moved literally into the English language unchanged. That's an N, believe it or not. G-E-N-E-A, if you transliterate the Greek letters for the word genea, it's just moved right into the English language, genealogia, genealogy. Now, the reason that I'm going to drive this point home is that you're going to see the word generation used a lot in Matthew. Our English word generation has that same G-E-N root. Our English word generation is a translation of the Greek word genea. Now, the reason that's important is because Matthew's going to use the word genea a lot. And he's going to use it in reference to generations of people who have a common root or a common descent, which is what the word genea means. It means people of a common descent, which is why when you have words about the genea, you have a genealogy. Here's the descent of these people, common descent. There's been a lot of confusion through the years about some of the things that Matthew records Jesus saying, like in Matthew 24, when he's going to say, this generation will not pass until all these things have been fulfilled. And people have glommed onto that and said, wait a minute, all those things in Matthew 24 weren't fulfilled within a generation, because they're taking the very modern concept of what a generation is, which is people all alive at a particular time and place. And they're saying that's what Jesus meant. It's not what he meant. What he meant was these people of a common descent, Israel, will not pass until all these things are fulfilled, because that's what they were asking him. And so as we continue working our way through the book of Matthew and we continue looking at how he uses the word genea in generation, you're going to see how consistently he refers to national Israel by the use of this word, and how consistently he says that God is still being faithful to national Israel, because after all, that's his audience. So now let's look at the genealogy. I won't keep you too much longer. If you have somewhere you gotta be, go. And at some point, it's going to sound like we're under an air raid, because the air show is in town. And for the last 3 days, they've been buzzing this building with the Blue Angels. There are like 5 fighter jets in formation that sweep right over this building. And they came so low yesterday that Tom said that one of the pilots had a mustache. So they came in low. So if you suddenly hear that happening, that's all that's happening. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. In the New Testament, you'll find 2 genealogies, one in Matthew, one in Luke. Luke follows the genealogy in a very Greek sort of form, in which he starts with Jesus and works his way backwards all the way to Adam. And again, remember why Luke is writing. Luke is writing for the purpose of proving that Jesus is the ultimate man. So of course he's going to trace him to Adam, the first man. Well, Matthew doesn't start at Adam. Matthew starts at Abraham, because his interest is the Abrahamic covenant and the Davidic covenant and the promises made to Israel. And so he's only out to prove that Jesus is the descendant of David so that he has the right to sit on the throne. And he's out to prove that he's the descendant of Abraham so that he is the fulfillment of the promise, through your seed, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. And so they have purposes for their particular genealogies. Matthew's genealogy, by the way, includes 5 women. During a period of time when genealogies were typically always traced by male descendants, he included some women. So whenever you hear people say, you know, Christianity keeps women down, and that's the way they say it, with that tone of voice, and they wag their finger. You know, Christianity is anti-women. I don't know, the first people Jesus ever said, go tell my disciples he is risen, women were told that. And in the genealogy at the very beginning of the New Testament, five women. Although some of those women are not women of particularly good repute. If you want to dig into the comparative genealogies between Luke and Matthew, back when we were working on the genealogy in Luke, I went into it in some depth. If you go to our website, click the listen link, go to Luke, go down, I think it's six or seven messages, you'll find the genealogies. And we go into it in some depth. And I took the time to kind of trace each of these five women. And when I got done with it, you'll hear one of the women in the room say, I feel better about myself now. Because the women, some of them are not women of particularly good reputation, and yet they're in the genealogy of Jesus. It's not uncommon in Jewish genealogies to jump generations, because all you're trying to prove in a genealogy is someone's pedigree. You're just trying to prove that they are connected to someone. So sometimes you will see, even in the Old Testament, you'll see examples, I'll show you one in a moment, of someone who is actually nephew to someone else, but he's called son of that person, even though we know he's nephew, because if he's nephew, then the father and the uncle have the same father, so it still proves descent, which is all a genealogy is trying to do. Matthew, in his genealogy, jumps generations so that he could get three groups of 14. And sometimes people ask, why 14? I think it was a mnemonic memorization device, because you had to be able to recite these things. You had to be able to recite your pedigree. You had to be able to say what your descent was. And so in proving the descent of Jesus, I think he did three groups of 14, because he was trying to show from Abraham to David, and then the succession of kings that lead to Jesus, there was another 14, and then the common people down to Mary, in order, or down to Joseph in this case, in order to show that he was a direct descendant of David. I'll just mention this, and if you want to look it up later, in 1 Chronicles 3:17-19, you read about the fact that there's a guy named Zerubbabel who is the nephew of Shealtiel. But in Ezra 3:2 and Nehemiah 12:1, you read that he is the son of Shealtiel. And so that's just proof, again, of how these genealogies work. It could jump from grandfather to son. It could go from uncle to son. As long as it proved family heritage, it was a legitimate genealogy. All right, so let's look down through some of these, shall we? The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. To Abraham was born Isaac, to Isaac Jacob, and to Jacob Judah and his brothers. And to Judah were born Perez and Zerah by Tamar. There's the first woman. Now, do you know how Perez and Zerah were formed in the womb of their mother? Do you know the story? Yeah, Tamar was actually married to one of Judah, who is a progenitor of one of the 12 tribes. I mean, Judah, who is, that's the tribe Jesus is going to come out of, as the genealogy cites. And in fact, when Jacob was old and leaning on his staff and had crossed his hands and had given the birthright blessing to Ephraim and Manasseh, he then prophesied over each of his sons, and he said that Judah was a lion's whelp, and that a lawgiver would not depart from Judah until Shiloh came, whose right it was to rule. And so clearly through Judah, the king, the Shiloh, the Messiah, was going to come, and that was predicted all the way back there when Isaac, who had his name changed to Israel, predicted that about the family of Judah. Okay, so now that line, the Judah line, has to continue no matter what, in order for Jesus to come through the line of Judah. He's even called the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. So this young girl was promised to Judah's oldest son, and the oldest son married her and then died without giving her a child. And so then Judah promised, well, you'll get my next son. And then the youngest, and he promised you'll have the youngest. And then when he was old enough to marry, Judah reneged on the deal. And so she had no children. So she, to use good old English King James language, played the harlot. And while she was playing the harlot, she went out to where she knew Judah was going to be. And Judah, this very righteous, holy progenitor of a tribe of Israel, no, he's just a flesh and blood guy, he decides, hey, look, a harlot. She had her face veiled, so he didn't know it was his daughter-in-law, and he went in unto her, and she was pregnant. He goes home, his servants come and say, hey, you know, your daughter-in-law, pregnant. He says, bring her in here, let's kill her. So this old guy, who's ready to judge her, when he was leaving, did one of those, you know, I'm fresh out of cash. I got nothing. And she says, well, leave me your staff and your signet ring as a promise that you're going to come back and pay me. And he agrees. You know, okay, well, here. He gets all upset and indignant at her. How did you end up pregnant? She brings out the staff and the signet ring. Bam is right. Yeah. And then he says, she's been more right than I've been because I kept withholding my sons from her. She's pregnant now by her father-in-law, and the tribe of Judah continues. God sovereignly working in very, very touchy situations. So anyway, my point is, she's in the genealogy. That's my point. There's Tamar right there. To Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron, Ram. And to Ram was born Abinadab, and to Abinadab, Nashan. And to Nashan, there was Salmon. And to Salmon was born Boaz by Rahab. Do you remember Boaz? Who is Boaz? To Salmon was born Boaz by Rahab. Who's Rahab? Rahab the harlot. Where is she? She's in Jericho. She's the one that hid the spies. She's right there in the genealogy of Jesus. Isn't that interesting? It's not like he has this sterling background. And I like that Matthew included all these. And then to Boaz was born Obed by Ruth. She's a Moabitess. She's not even an Israelite. But she was married to Boaz. You know that story. Go back and read the book of Ruth. And to Jesse was born David the king. Okay, that's where he wanted to get. He wanted to make the connection between Abraham to David. Now he's going to prove that Jesus is the son of David. So he's done 14 generations in order to get to David the king. And to David was born Solomon by her who had been wife of Uriah. You know that story? That's David getting her pregnant and then murdering her husband. And then God kills that baby. And then they have another one, Solomon. Again, this is not a glowing recommendation. This is a line of sinners. To Solomon was born Rehoboam, and to Rehoboam, Abijah, and to Abijah, Asa, and to Asa was born Jehoshaphat, and to Jehoshaphat, Joram, and to Joram, Uzziah, and to Uzziah was born Jotham, and to Jotham, Ahaz, and to Ahaz, Hezekiah. To Hezekiah was born Manasseh, and to Manasseh, Amon, and to Amon, Josiah. Right there. What a surprise. And to Josiah was born Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation into Babylon. So now you know the time frame. After the deportation to Babylon, to Jeconiah was born Shealtiel, and to Shealtiel, Zerubbabel, and to Zerubbabel was born Abihud, and to Abihud, Eliakim, and to Eliakim, Azor, and to Azor was born Zadok, and to Zadok, Akim, and to Akim, Eliud, and to Eliud was born Eleazar, and to Eleazar, Matthan, and to Matthan, Jacob, and to Jacob was born Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom was born Jesus, who is called the Christ. Therefore, all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the time of Christ, 14 generations. Now, you could read that as I just did, and I pronounced some of those names reasonably close. And you could read that and read right past the fact that right in the middle of it is a great big red flag to any Israelite. Because Matthew is trying to prove that Jesus is the descendant of David and that he is the Messiah, the king. Therefore, he has the right to sit on David's throne. Except that there is a line, a cursed line, right in the middle of the genealogy. You're going to read about Jeconiah. Jeconiah could never sit on David's throne, according to Jeremiah 36. You can go back and you can read the story. Jeremiah, through Baruch, his servant, said, I'm shut up in my house. You go to the king, and you go tell the king that God has put all these curses on him. And when he took it to the king, the king's servant took it to the king heard a little bit of it, ripped it all up, threw it in the fire. For that reason, Jeremiah 36:30 says, therefore, thus says the Lord concerning Jehoiakim, king of Judah, he shall have no one to sit on the throne of David, and his dead body shall be cast out to the heat of the day and to the frost of the night. I shall also punish him and his descendants and his servants for their iniquity, and I shall bring on them and the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the men of Judah all the calamity that I have declared on them, but they did not listen. We just read, as we worked our way through the genealogy, that Jeconiah is the forefather of Joseph, who is Jesus' father, but he is a descendant of Jehoiakim, which means that if Jesus is only a descendant through Jehoiakim of Joseph, he can't sit on the throne of David. And that is why Luke also writes a genealogy. Because in Luke's genealogy, he goes through a different descendant of David that isn't under the curse, and traces it all the way to a guy named Heli. This is fascinating because he then says, Heli, who is the father of Joseph, and Luke takes the time to say, who is supposed to have been the father of Jesus. Because Luke knows if the virgin birth is true, it only matters what Mary's genealogy is. And then you can read in the Hebrew record, the Jerusalem Talmud indicates that Mary was the daughter of Heli. And the fact that Joseph married Mary makes him son-in-law of Heli, and so he's called son of Heli. In other words, Luke gives you Mary's genealogy, Matthew gives you Joseph's genealogy. You put the two together, and you have both his legal right to sit on the throne, and you have the heritage by both parents that he is a direct descendant from David. And in order to avoid the curse that would have kept him off the throne, virgin birth. Isn't that amazing? I mean, people go, why genealogies? Why do we have genealogies? Because you could just read a bunch of names and go, they're just begatting all over the place. I have no idea what's happening there. But when you look at the genealogies and you compare them, you also see the sovereign hand of God who was able to curse one line of David and make sure that Jesus came through a different line of David. And by the virgin birth and the fact that she came through the Davidic line as well, he has the legal and the genealogical right to sit on the throne. I love the Bible. I have so much fun reading the Bible, and you can just dig through this stuff, and there's hidden treasure everywhere, and it's just so much fun to read. So, that, my friends, is an introduction to the book of Matthew. We even got through the first genealogies, and we reached the point where we're ready to get into the actual story. We'll get to the birth narrative in 3 weeks. I hope that whet your appetite for the book of Matthew. Trust me when I tell you, the whole rest of the book is just as fascinating as that, because Matthew's a smart guy. Matthew is in tune, and Matthew is picking and choosing this stuff out of the Old Testament and laying down proofs and evidences and saying, look, I'm telling you, this is him. God's been quiet for 400 years, but he's talking, and he's talking loud, and he's talking through his son, and this is him. He is the Messiah. And then Matthew's going to take the time to say, and there's all these promises that God made to Israel that are still good, that are still right, that are still legit, that are still going to happen. There's so much to talk about. So maybe Jesus will come back before we get through this book. We'll find out. But if not, there were a lot of people out there voting for 1st and 2nd Chronicles who are waiting their turn. So maybe we'll get to them. But I'm going to enjoy teaching this. I hope you'll enjoy learning it. Any questions?
You know, let me get this straight. Mary was from King David's seed also?
Yes. Right? Yeah. But not through Solomon. Through a different son. And again, when you go home, click the listen link on our website. Go to Luke, and then go down, I think it's about 6 or 7 messages. There's a message just called The Genealogies. And I went into greater depth than I did this morning, comparing the Luke and the Matthew genealogies and demonstrating what I said this morning. Yes, sir?
Was the curse on Joseph's side?
Yes. And so it's good that he wasn't the flesh and blood dad. But he was called the son of Heli when he married Mary, which put him in the blessed line. Like, God knows what he's doing. Yeah, exactly. That's just sovereignty. This person put them together. It wasn't it lucky that of all the people who lived in that area at that time, that Joseph and Mary just happened to find each other? And they both just happened to have that right heritage? God got so lucky. Any other questions? All right, good. We'll be here Wednesday night. Come see us Wednesday night as we continue pneumatology. We might even wrap it up. No promises, but we might wrap it up. And then be here the following Wednesday. Be here for 2 Sundays. I am so very, very grateful that the folk here at GCA, the musicians here, the leaders here, are able to just keep it going in my absence. Thanks very much for giving me the freedom to do a little bit of traveling. I appreciate it very much. And pray for me, please, not only for my back, but I'll be teaching for 5 nights in Mesquite, Texas. So pray that my back and my voice and my health holds out. And it's a lot of driving. So, oh, I'm not allowed to call them the internet folk anymore. They want to be called the digital congregation. I know. Say goodbye to the digital congregation.
Thank you for listening to this Sunday morning message from Grace Christian Assembly. Please visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And join us next time as we gather around the Word and study God's sovereign grace.